In this section, we will make several stops with short walks in between. After giving instructions to the next stop, I will say pause. Do so, walk to the stop, and restart the audio. Where a parking lot now lies across Market Street, a rectangular wooden building you see from one end is used as an army hospital during the British occupation. Among its patients would have been some of the wounded from Guildford Courthouse. Those too weak to walk were floated across the Cape Fear by boat over the 2 days before the main army's arrival, described below. Cross 2nd Street and stop on the corner by the bank. Pause. Here, or perhaps a little farther along 2nd, stands a place of misery during Craig's time. In a low spot in the ground, now covered by the modern bank building, was a corral of sorts, a high fence of rails with no roof. Called the bullpen, Craig keeps captured patriots here, exposed to the sun and rain. Perhaps you see, through the slats, John Ash huddled in a corner, shivering and covered in sores. Ash had been a member of the Provincial Assembly, the colonial legislature, but became a leader of the Stamp Act protests in the 1760s. A patriot officer at the Battle of Moore's Creek Bridge, which ended Governor Martin's hopes of reclaiming the colony in 1776, he was appointed a brigadier general in the state militia later that year. When the British arrived, he went into hiding, but was betrayed and imprisoned here. During a long stay, he got smallpox. Finally released due to the illness, he died on the way to his family in Hillsborough. Another victim of the bullpen was political leader Cornelius Harnett, described below at his grave. Continue another block until you are across from the Burgwyn Wright House at 3rd Street and look farther up Market. Pause. During the war, you just walked the entire width of Wilmington proper, though homes are scattered throughout a larger area. The town only goes one more block to the left, to Chestnut Street, and two to the right where Orange is today, though there is no street there yet. Around 3 p.m. on Wednesday, May 8, 1775, a rider gallops into town from ahead of you, down the dirt road from Newburn that becomes Market Street at this intersection. He likely continues down to the courthouse. He announces that American militia fired on British troops in Lexington and Concord, Massachusetts on April 19. It has taken exactly 2 weeks for the news to get here, by horseback, of the first military action of the American Revolution. Look left, up 3rd Street. Cornwallis's army arrives here from Guildford Courthouse over 2 days, starting Wednesday, April 11, 1781. The army marches in along 3rd Street and eventually into the encampment past modern Orange Street. There his 1,700 men, including 225 North Carolina Loyalists, plus camp followers and people escaping slavery, crowd into Craig's fortifications. A letter Cornwallis writes 3 days later to his commander Sir Henry Clinton in New York City both explains his decision and describes the men you see. With a third of my army sick and wounded, which I was obliged to carry in wagons or on horseback, the remainder without shoes and worn down with fatigue, I thought it was time to look for some place of rest and refreshment. With them are Hessian mercenaries who fought alongside the Redcoats at Guildford. A German soldier in the von Bos regiment recalled that they received double rations of rum each day and plenty of provisions of meat and ship's bread, also called hardtack, long-lasting and cracker-like. Shoes, shirts, and breeches were replaced, welcome changes for the men in worn-out clothing. Meanwhile, Cornwallis writes an officer friend, "Now, my dear friend, what is our plan?" As his army heals, he debates at least 8 different options, according to his letters. Eventually, he decides, against late arriving orders from Clinton, to move to Virginia. He hopes to join up with another British army there. Just 2 weeks after arriving here, they pack up camp, drums roll, columns form, and Cornwallis's army marches back out 3rd Street to its eventual surrender at Yorktown. The impact of his North Carolina campaign on that army shows in his returns, or troop counts. He entered the state in January with 3,224. He leaves 3 months later with half that number, 1,723. Craig's force remains behind to keep the port open for supplies. Cross Market to the Burgwyn Wright House. Pause. This home was built in 1770 atop the former county jail for John Burgwyn, the royal treasurer of the colony of North Carolina. This was intended only to be a showcase and guest home. He continued to live at his plantation, The Hermitage, in today's Castle Hayne, north of town, and use an older home near here as his townhouse. An English immigrant at 19, Burgwyn became a merchant and planter. He married into money, but his wife died before the war. Having served as the private secretary to previous royal governors, and also the Register of Deeds as war broke out, Burgwyn was the highest-ranking British official in town, so he was probably a loyalist. A game of blind man's bluff turned out badly when Bergwin fell and broke his leg. He must have decided this was a good excuse to get out of town, all the way to England, supposedly for treatment. Bergwin returned to North Carolina a couple of times during the war, however. He rented out his home at the start of the war to the Wrights, who would later buy it. Among his other properties were as many as 200 forced laborers, including at least 10 enslaved at this house. Cornwallis is entertained here at least one night. A local writes of seeing him come down the wooden front steps after a party. The host is unknown, as records do not indicate whether any of the Wrights were here at the time, or whether officers were housed here. Also unclear is where his headquarters were, though it was not here, contrary to a nearby monument. Other intriguing stories told about the house are also, sadly, untrue. Despite never openly declaring himself a Tory, Bergwin sought and received a pardon under the terms of the Treaty of Paris that ended the war and returned with his English wife and children. They lived at his plantation and sold the house here, confiscated by the state like many Loyalist properties after 10 years of petitioning to get it back. You can learn more of the home's fascinating history and stand where Cornwallis did by touring the house. Continue on to the walking instructions and audio clip under A Walk Through the Church.